this is a term that I didn't come up with. It's by Professor O. He termed Israel not as a democracy, but as an ethnocracy. So it's a democracy only for one ethnos, which is the Jewish ethnos. And even that is not a really on equal terms, because you have the Ashkenazi Jews and the Sephardi or the Mizrahi Jews, and the way Ashkenazi Jews were treated in Europe is the same way that they treated the Mizrahi Jews in Israel. Right. So they discriminated against them. They thought they were not good enough Jews, and they could be the cheap human power, human labor that could do the hard jobs, the manual labor, and if they'll be corrected and they will be civilized in the right means, they'll become good Jews in the end. And so that colonization has happened on as a like a double whammy, so to speak. And in that process, the Ashkenazi Jews have orientalized the Mizrahi Jews. That's why they're called Mizrahi. Mizrahi means of the Orient. And they placed them in that social political hierarchy at the bottom, and then the Palestinians were not even in that social hierarchy at all, because they were deemed as the enemy rather than be deemed as partners, equal partners to start off with.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Green Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth.
Kia ora and welcome. I'm Lisa Eyre, and this is Green Planet FM. Now today I have in the studio Dr. Hadas Orr, who will be speaking about contemporary Maori Jews, which is the subject for her postdoctoral project. There has been a Jewish history in New Zealand since the beginning of the 19th century, so it should come as no surprise that some of our population identify as Maori Jews. This is a segment population, however, that most of us know very little about. Hadas is a Jewish Israeli migrant mother of three who has made her home in New Zealand in the past 16 years. She is also a social anthropologist. As a social researcher, she worked for the Israeli Parliament in the Education Committee and the Van Leer Institute in Jerusalem. She is also interested in using her own social privileges as a Jewish Israeli academic woman for ameliorating the Palestinian situation by speaking out about it. We'll be talking about that later in the interview. Now, kia ora and welcome, Hadas. This was a really interesting idea to do a doctorate on Maori Jews. What made you want to do that?
Oh, firstly, it's my postdoctorate. So my doctorate is about my own group of Jewish Israeli migrants. Well, as I was conducting my fieldwork in my doctorate research, I came across a couple of women who married Maori men. And then I thought, oh, it'd be interesting to look into this further and find out what and how things have been maintained in the home and the differences in generations. And so I decided this would be also an opportunity for me to pay back to the tangata whenua, because I could see there's an unspoken gap between, you know, the relationships of migrants and the tangata whenua. And so I decided this is my own way of paying back, as well as being a good academic and finding a loophole or a lacuna where I can actually contribute some kind of knowledge to the national history of New Zealand. So it's a combination of my private interest in paying it forward, as well as my academic interest in the long-standing relationship between Maori and Jews.
Right, because when I decided to do this topic and interview you, I did some Googling, and I couldn't really find very much about it at all. Mm. And so I thought, well, here I am going into an interview without much information.
Yes. So it is the beginning. It's the start because it hasn't been researched, and definitely not by someone who's, I would say, more politically aware, because the research that has been done is mostly in history, and it is looked at the relationship between Maori and Jews, but completely ignoring intermarriages and the offsprings of these intermarriages. And also, it was more coming from a point of view as us Jews, we are so, you know, we are the unique chosen people. And so we have had a huge impact. We've punched above our weight, and therefore we've left an impact. And it was much more focused on the Jewish side, so the Maori side was completely ignored. And I wanted to correct this kind of way of thinking. I wanted it to be a lot more balanced and fair, and also a lot more up-to-date. And so looking at contemporary Maori Jews as something that has not been done at all. And I was lucky enough to meet my postdoctoral supervisor, Dr. Carla Hokamau, and she's done some research about the way Maori identify in mixed ethnicity and their well-being and success in life. And she found that, in fact, for Maori, the more you identify with other ethnicities, the more well off you are in terms of your general oranga, your well-being, as well as in economic terms. And so this was a further investigation into these findings. And the group of Maori Jews is quite well off, and they're highly educated. And so they own their own houses, and a lot of them have tertiary education. So it is it's basically breaking the stereotype of, you know, the poor, miserable, impoverished Maoris who've got no better choice than just, you know, marrying out in order to ameliorate their situation. So it's an attempt to break that stereotype in understanding what it is in that combination of cultures that makes Maori Jews well off and have a higher well-being.
You think somewhere along the line the value of education really has come through with that?
No, well, it's an interesting question, because it is the you are actually repeating this stereotype of, you know, the educated Jew who's part of the people of the book. I found it actually comes from the Maori side, the education, the understanding that education, and basically tertiary education, is a way to develop political awareness and to bring better well-being to yourself and the whānau and your hapu and iwi. So it's not just a personal journey. And I found that there's actually a lot of racism within the whānau, between the Maori and the Jewish side. So I can't say that the, you know, the desire to get education comes from the Jewish side. Definitely, it's a way to overcome racism within the whānau, and it is a way to carve out a political awareness. But it's definitely not coming from the Jewish side.
Okay. Well, no, and I use the word education. I should qualify that, because there is an awful lot that Indigenous Maori have to teach us too.
Yeah.
So I was normal way of speaking and not acknowledging their wonderful heritage of spirituality and those sorts of things, of which I have been quite involved with various friends.
Mm.
So I apologize for that.
It's okay. It's okay.
So can you tell me more about the people that you interviewed?
Okay, so I've got 21 interviewees, and they basically vary between three generations. So there's the young, what I call loud and prouder generation, and these are the people who are all about, look at me, I am so cool, I'm Maori and Jewish, and I don't fit in the stereotype because I'm gorgeous. And and then there's the middle generation, people of my age group, so they're like in their middle age, and they are the people who are busiest with contestation and It's sort of suited really well with their stage in life, the way they perceive the world and their role within their whānau and the world. And they are a lot more into struggles and political awareness. And then there's the older generation, and I happen to interview mostly women in that generation. So I've got 6 women and 1 men, and they are over 50 years old, and they are the most comfortable in their own skin. So they are not too fussed about the fact that they're Maori and Jewish, but they've done a really long journey in terms of their just not just self-determinism, but also their education, and they've had masters and PhDs, and yeah, they're fascinating and quite inspirational, actually. So that's my favorite part in terms of writing, because it's a lot more interesting, I think, to see about their way of understanding what is mana wahine, so their kind of feminist views, as well as how these are integrated with being Maori and being Jewish. And they don't make a fuss out of any, you know, part of their identity, but they certainly are very close to their Maori whakapapa, and they know their whakapapa really well. The Jewish side is more like, I'd say the Jewish identity they have is quiet, but it is very respectful. It's not loud, and it's not ashamed, that's for sure. I can't say it's not important. It is very important. It is very much part of them. But they did not choose to act on it, so to speak. So because I'm a social anthropologist, I want to make a difference between performance and acting. So it is, they don't perform as a Jewish Maori.
That, so they're means, more likely to, we're more likely just to see them as Maori?
Probably, and some people wouldn't know unless they asked them and they had a conversation with them, that they wouldn't know. People who've known them for many years would not know necessarily that they are Maori and Jewish. But they see it as a quite integral part to what they, who they are. So I, in my research, one of my goals is to break also that scheme or that way of thinking that you're 50% this or 50% that. It's not about percentages. It's a really wholesome perception of who you are and where you come from and who's your whakapapa. And so they do not quantify it and say, oh, I am 8 Jewish and, I don't know, 8 Maori. It's not about that at all. So it's about what you actually act on in life. And that came across in the research when I looked into food and funerary practices. So, for example, how they would bury their dead in terms of the ceremony that the family will hold at the time, which would often combine Maori and Jewish practices.
Okay, so Jewish have a definite practice for funerals.
Yeah.
Well, what would that be?
Okay, so usually you bury on the day of the departure from this world. So when the deceased dies, you try and bury on the same day. Which is unlike the Maori practice where you can have a tangi for 3-4 days. So you have to find a compromise between these practices. And then you bury usually just wrapped up with linen, white linen, so, and the body is naked. You have to purify it before. You have to clean it. And then there's a rabbi usually, but it's not always necessary. And you say the Kaddish, which is a special prayer for departing from the deceased. And then you sit Shiva, which is usually 7 days of mourning, where you're not allowed to cook. Some people don't look. It depends, again, on your Jewish ancestry and what kind of practice you follow. But you are not allowed to look in mirrors because it's vanity and pleasure. And so you cover all the mirrors in the house. You don't cook. You don't shave if you're a man. Yeah, that's pretty much it. And you just sit down on pillows low, so you don't even sit on a comfortable chair. You are trying to avoid any comfort. in those 7 days. And Maori, some Maori also practice a similar mourning period, which is after, before the actual burial. And one other thing is you do not bury in a coffin. For Jews, you bury just the body on, a piece of cloth and some sticks that you hold on to. So what I've found is that Maori Jews find different ways of practicing kind of both spiritual belongings. So they would have, for example, if it was a man who had a bar mitzvah, they would bury him. They might bury him with a kippah, with the head cover for men that you start wearing after the bar mitzvah. So they might bury them with a kippah, or they might bury a woman with cloak, the Maori cloak.
Yes.
Yeah, and they would have a rabbi or somebody who would say the Kaddish or some Jewish prayers as well as, you know, the Maori prayers and songs. And so it's an amalgamation. It's a combination that has to fit the family and the person who's been buried and their story in life and what they have been through. So if they've been through a bar mitzvah or not, that would be one thing. And the other area would be the food. So food is something that bears memory kind of long-term for different generations. So mainly bread making is something, or baking in general, is something that I've found that people have maintained recipes that are both Maori and Jewish, and they use them in different celebrations. Sometimes, you know, they make a Passover cake for Christmas because it's a festive cake and it's quite rich, and it's and actually from Ashkenazi German sort of recipe type. And they would tear the bread in a special way, like you break the bread on the Friday Kiddush, the ceremony for welcoming the Shabbat. And then I found that there's a lot of, you know, Jews who've picked up on the Maori culture when they intermarried, and they basically found home in that culture. They were embraced, they learned the language, they learned the practices, they learned recipes, they felt at home. And so that was passed on to their children, along with other things that, you know, made them feel Jewish as well.
And there have been people coming here, Jewish people coming here and intermarrying since the 19th century.
Yes.
So some of that could go back quite a long way.
Mm.
Who were these people that came over?
So in the beginning of the 19th century, it would have been mostly Jewish migrant men who were middle class, educated, English. Some of them were lawyers, trained doctors, merchants, artists, and they came to New Zealand, and there were no Jewish women to marry, and they married Maori women. And they also did that for economic reasons and commercial reasons. They wanted to, you know, put their roots in the land and get access to land and employees, and they wanted to feel at home and welcomed. And so they had intermarried or had a relationship with Maori women who were usually high-ranking women. So that was, strategic decision on both parts. And definitely not refugees, like I have had that question before. The refugees came along later on, but that wasn't the majority, and that wasn't the only reason why they would marry Maori. But they were in later on. Later years, there were some refugees, but that's not the majority of Jews who married Maori, actually.
Right, it was more earlier on.
Yes.
And
it was out of choice, perhaps they fell in love. It's hard to tell because there's no documentation of these relationships. Definitely strategic, and they had very successful families, very prolific. One of these women who was Maori, she married her name was Annie Mere, and she married Solomon Yates, and she became the first woman millionaire in New Zealand because she basically lived after him. She was 20 years younger, and she was a great horsewoman and a great businesswoman, and she had hold of 350,000 acres in Northland. She ran the first shop in Northland, and she had about 350 employees. Some of them were Maori, but not only. I think she was also involved with the gum digging fields, and so she was the first woman millionaire in New Zealand. And her descendants, which are the Yates, some of them are the Yates, not only.
Yates for those seeds.
I do not know, actually. I have not dug into that one, but she's got other descendants. And so, yeah, it was a very prolific family, and it was very well off, and it's done really well in general. A lot of it is thanks to her. Not just thanks to the Jewish bloodline. So the talent and the wisdom and the strong bond and the connections and the knowledge, the cultural knowledge, was coming on both parts. So coming from both parts, yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. But I was thinking if they came to, because they wanted land to be here and they wanted land, then of course so many Maori lost their land.
Yeah.
So the Jewish settlers lost the land with their wives?
Some of them. Yeah, there's a case of, I think he was believed to be the first Jew. He's had a case in court against the crown because he's lost the land, and there was a fire that was set and demolished all his art. So some of them did lose the land, yeah. But some of them have maintained it. It depends, I guess, on a lot of different factors, because the crown did prefer certain tribes, certain iwi, and it did the, you know, usual system of, preference so that they have better control.
Divide and conquer.
Divide and conquer, exactly. So it depends on which tribe, I guess, the Jews have integrated with.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
If they managed to keep their land or not, and how much they've kept out of it. But generally speaking, that's the part of the, you know, the first generation of Jews who came here as migrants from England, and then there were later on there were some refugees, and then there's some also Israelis who came here traveling and married or met their partners, their Maori partners, in usually England. So it's an ongoing relationship that keeps changing according to the historical cultural context, but it's always been there. And it's never been researched because it's never been acknowledged, I think, for various reasons, that it was an equal sort of kind of marriage on both parts. So it was not because the Jews were better or they were more sophisticated in getting, a way to get land, or the other way around. It wasn't because the Maori were better. And then I think the interesting thing is to see the differences between the generations and how it's been manifested and expressed in, different... all of them are Maori Jewish, but they're of different age groups. So, yeah.
But they're not... They haven't lost the Jewish heritage. You see, I've met many Maori who say, oh, well, you know, I'm part Scottish or I'm part Spanish or something like that, but there's not... they haven't carried on any of the traditions from those other countries. But it would appear that Maori Jews are doing that.
Well, some of them have.
Yes.
Again, it depends on which generation you belong to. And also, I guess it depends on the family as well. So the older women, some of them have gone back to Israel and spent time in a kibbutz, learned Hebrew, and then came back to New Zealand. So that definitely enhanced the Jewish practices, or even the worldview, and looking at things from a specific or a certain perspective, even just reading the New Zealand political map, that's, they can do both. They can do Maori reading and Jewish reading. And then some of them didn't really act on their Jewishness in a way that you could say, oh, actually, this person has maintained the tradition. So it varies. It varies quite considerably.
Right.
Yeah. It's quite a big spectrum where you have, I've got at least one interviewee, and she's just recently found out that she's also Jewish, not only Maori. And so she's never practiced anything Jewish. But that knowledge makes a difference in people's life. And sometimes they're in later years, you know, they decide to act on it. And so one guy I interviewed, he decided to try and immigrate to Israel and have a fresh start in his life. And so he's gone through the Orthodox conversion. Although he was Jewish, he knew that it's not going to be recognized by the state of Israel. And so he decided that he's going to go the full Monty. So he's had circumcision at the age of 40. And he's done his bar mitzvah at the age of, I don't know, 42. And he's learned Hebrew, and he's done everything he could to, you know, fulfill all the requirements of an Orthodox conversion. And he was still denied to make my immigration as a Jew in Israel, but for other reasons.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, so as I'm saying, it is quite a wide spectrum. So you would have people who have maintained Maori and Jewish practices and traditions.
And also, that includes circumcision?
And in some cases.
Yes.
This guy wasn't circumcised because he's had hippie mothers, and they decided they don't want to do circumcision, although he knew all the time that he was Jewish.
Right.
When he was growing up in New Zealand in the 60s. And so you'd have people in this spectrum who have practiced the traditions and maintained and have really strong integration of them. Some of them, because when the political awakening of the Maori happened since the 1980s, that's also affected the Jewish awakening in their lives. And then you would have people who actually only recently learned that they are Maori and Jewish and might decide to act on it one day when the time is suited for them and the conditions are ripe to, you know, make a change in their lives. It's hard to tell, but I can, probably predict that it can happen in the future in their lives. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's incredibly interesting. And, of course, there's different types of Jews, aren't there? So the Maori Jews here have also other divisions in the Jewish, just like you'd have a Maori tribe. You might be Napui or Tuhoi or something, which could be quite different.
Yes.
So you've got people out of the ones that you interviewed. You had Ashkenazi and
Sephardi.
Right. Just two.
Yeah. I can't say that I can find many differences in terms of the practices, but probably food would be the main thing, because the Sephardi Jewish cuisine is quite different to the Ashkenazi Jewish cuisine, because it's been affected by the countries where these cultures were established and constituted along the history. So Ashkenazi Jews are from East Central Europe, and so they have been affected by this kind of European cuisine, and, you know, the source of nourishment that they had in these countries. So it's more cabbage and a lot less tomatoes, for example. They do come, are more, you know, suited to grow in the Middle East, and not, the food is not spicy, it's a lot sweeter. And then Sephardi Jews have had a strong influence by the countries that they've lived on for centuries, so they have a completely different cuisine. And in my group of interviewees, I've got one Sephardi Jew, and the rest are all Ashkenazi. So, yeah, it's quite difficult to tell the difference, you know, now in the future generations since their intermarriage has happened. Yeah, and again, from the Maori side, you'd have different tribes, but mostly of a North Island, so rarely from the South Island. But it's all around the different tribes. It's not just one tribe that has intermarried with Jews. Yeah, and they're very much part of the Maori history. As I said, a lot of them took on the Maori culture and they learned the language and the customs and the practices. And so I won't say they lost their Judaism, but I would say they certainly made a point of being a proud Maori at the same time.
Well, that's wonderful.
Hmm.
And you've also done a lot of study on the cooking.
Yes, that was my PhD.
Okay, and the PhD was on exactly, the topic was?
So the topic was the Jewish-Israeli way that women changed their everyday food practices after migration in New Zealand. So I looked at my own group of Jewish-Israeli women who came here since the early 2000s, and I asked how did migration affect their everyday practices of cooking? Firstly, grocery shopping, then cooking, and then baking, and two different types of hospitality, so the festive hospitality and the casual one, and then dieting for weight management.
I should talk to you about that offline.
Yeah, it's like a full circle, basically. Yeah, and I found something that I didn't really anticipate. I found a different type of nostalgia that these women have, and it is a lot more contesting and ambivalent nostalgia. So firstly, they have the longing and the, you know, desire to go home and the pain of that longing and that sense of void and emptiness. And then you have all these memories that are surging and evoked by the food that they cook, or I should say we cook, in order to go back home, travel in our imagination and through our senses. And then comes the ambivalence, you know, you actually remember why you left that home and about all the relationship that food stands for and materializes in your life. And then comes along the self-irony. So it's like a three-step sort of nostalgia. First the longing, then the ambivalence, and then self-irony, because you start laughing at yourself thinking, oh, that's a bit silly. I actually understand that I'm longing for a home that I am never going to find. That's a bit silly of me. And yeah, and that raises a lot of humor.
Yes. Well, once you've emigrated, you really belong to two places. So it's very difficult, isn't it? So to...
Yes, and in a case of migrants that are Jews, it's also more than two places, because they carry on, as again, we're back to the issue of the Jewish ethnicities, they carry on the, you know, the practices and the taste and the memories of their foremothers and forefathers who came from Morocco or Iraq or from Poland or Russia or wherever they came from to Israel. And so it's a lot more than just two states.
Yes.
It goes a long way. It goes a really long way. And that sense of belonging might surge up when they visit Poland and they feel that when they're having the chicken soup there, it's just the same as their grandmother's chicken soup. Or the same in Morocco when they go and visit the market and have the tomato salad that they call marduma or madbucha. That's just like the madbucha or marduma that their grandmothers used to make. So it makes them feel at home.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sometimes difficult with ingredients to make the same as one that would have at home.
Oh, it's always
and I've
difficult.
I've experienced that very much in trying to cook Turkish meals for my Turkish ex-husband when we were married. I could never quite do it. In fact, in the end, I gave up.
Yes, you do.
Because I thought, well, if I'm not really making proper Turkish food, then I should probably just give up and he can eat what I need.
Yeah, it's that sense of losing something that you've never actually had.
Yes.
It's almost like the phantom of a lost limb that you've kind of lost, and you still feel that pain, although you know it's not there.
Well, in a minute, I'll talk to you about that loss when we're talking about land loss.
Mm.
But this is Green Planet FM, and I am Lisa Eyre, and I'm interviewing Dr. Hadas Orr. So, Hadas, you have quite a compassionate view as to the Palestinian question. How is that for you when you're in Israel?
I strive for compassion. It's not an easy thing to keep hold on to. It's something you have to kind of maintain and nourish in your mind constantly. And when I'm in Israel, well, I left 16 years ago, but I actually never left, so I keep coming back and visits. Well, I've learned to try and avoid political discussions with my family, especially my brother, who's an Orthodox Jew by now. So he's gone through what we call in Israel the return in answer. It's a literal translation. So he became an Orthodox Jew, and he said to me at some stage, I don't want to discuss with you anything political because it defiliates the air. And so I avoid that topic completely with him, and I respect it's his choice, and it just brings out very bad vibes in our relationships, so I avoid that completely. But in general, it's not an easy place to be in Israel for me because of my political views. And as I was saying, ethnically speaking, I belong to the elite, so because I'm Ashkenazi, and I would like to use my privileges as an Ashkenazi to, you know, make it better for the Palestinians, but I find it really difficult because immediately you become prey for violence, and you become the prey for basically aggression that is either verbal or physical. And that position, taking that position, is difficult within the family context as well, because it brings up a lot of tension. My mom, again, I can't talk politics with her. She doesn't want to hear anything negative, no criticism, just, you know, being positive. As if being positive makes everything positive in the world.
Well, there's many people in that situation here, yeah, in New Zealand about things.
Yeah, so it's in complete, you know, denial and acceptance of any kind of criticism or comparisons, God forbid, to anything that is perceived as quite negative in the majority's view. Not just in Israel, but, yeah, specifically or mainly in Israel.
So you're questioning the situation with the settlers?
Well, yeah, and I'm taking a political stance. I don't buy anything that was made in the occupied territories. I haven't stepped there in ages. Yeah, and universities that are like Ariel, that is settled in Ariel, I would not have anything to do with them.
Can you explain that, Ariel?
Ariel is in the occupied territories, and it's like a college, but it's actually gone, I think, to a university stage now. And so, like the academic boycott, yeah, I do take a stance in that. So I am part of the academic boycott on Israeli institutes, academic institutes, and especially those who are in the occupied territories. Anything I can do to make a stand doesn't really, well, it does out you in a way, but it's not involving going out in the streets and yelling out, because I found that doesn't really work much.
Might work better here, but
yeah, maybe here a little bit better, but even that, yeah.
So you disapprove of the new settlements and the land that was taken basically after the Balfour Agreement and the initial Israel was established?
Yes.
This is your stand?
Yeah.
Yes. Gaza is now in the situation where it's going to be uninhabitable by 2020, and there's a million people there.
Yeah.
Have you any thoughts on that one?
Well, I've got plenty of thoughts, but they... yeah, I'm not sure. it's always useful to share them. As I said, I don't share them with my family. I find that I do share them a lot more with strangers because there's less commitment to, you know, long-term relationship with these people. Yeah, I just think there has to be found a different solution. I do take the Maori situation as an example in terms of negotiating a resolution. Like the Maoris have had claims and have had a court that discusses the claims, even though it's a long-term process and there's a lot that can be still done. I think at least it leads a way in terms of a finding a resolution and a solution for the future generations. And I think it's outrageous what has been done in Gaza. And the situation there is just horrifying. And I wouldn't want to have anybody that I know live in such conditions, let alone strangers. What I think is that if this is not a suitable place for you to live in, why would you let others live in this kind of place or these kind of conditions? What I follow the Torah in that sense. So what I don't like to be done to me, I wouldn't want to inflict on others. The way I want to be treated is the way I want to treat others, so that there's that kind of reciprocity. So I didn't make that rule up, but I do truly think that what is happening in Gaza is abhorring and has to be stopped. And I do think that what is going to stop Israel is a lot of external pressure, but it looks like it's going to be even more extreme. So it's going from one extreme to another extreme. So I don't really know. I don't have a solution, a magical solution. But I do think that the Jewish migrants or Jews in general outside the boundaries of Israel have a lot of say and can impact, not just by boycotting academic institutions, even just by their power as consumers. That is a huge avenue for taking a stand and making an impact. But I think there's a lot more that has to be done in various arenas at the same time to create that kind of pressure, so that Jewish population in Israel also makes a change. Because if you still have Bibi Netanyahu as a prime minister and all his crew, don't stand much of a chance for a change.
No, I was very shocked when he got in and he's still there.
Yeah.
So it's really, I mean, we could all boycott Israeli goods.
Mm.
I mean, I do actually.
A moment of confession.
Yes, I do, because I do. It's very difficult. We understand that the Israelis, that the Jewish people needed a home, but what they've done when they've got the home to take more and more and more and more, so that there is so little left. I don't even think many people understand just how much land has been taken.
But yeah,
it's massive.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, especially in Gaza, it's almost like the Palestinians are in a sort of large concentration camp, really, and they're eventually going to die.
Yeah, they are in a concentration camp.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's seeing the bigger picture of how what was done is now being recreated.
They're making the same exact mistakes that have been done towards Jews, and it's really, really heartbreaking.
And it's so sad that not many people can see that.
I agree. Although I have come across a few Holocaust survivors who've taken that stance and do see it that way and make that comparison. But if you make that comparison from within the boundaries of Israel, you are putting yourself at a lot more danger.
Yes.
And then when you're making these comparisons and, really making a stance there from outside the boundaries of Israel. I know there's one at least American Jewish Holocaust survivor who's made that comparison, that this is just the same as the Germans' concentration camps. And it was made by one famous singer within the boundaries of Israel, and she was denied the Israel Prize because of that. So there's a high price to pay for both actions. But I think it's more personal when you're exposing your opinions in Israel and criticizing it. And then, as I said, you become persecuted, basically.
So that's actually terrible, isn't it? So there's not really freedom of speech in Israel.
No, there isn't. No.
And maybe that's something that can be advertised. No freedom of speech for Israelis.
No, I think they have very little. Maybe Facebook is helping a little bit, but it's just awful to read. The talkbacks that you get on Facebook is just horrific. And then you have people, you know, being threatened to be killed because of what they put on Facebook, or they'd be denied all sorts of rights, human rights. Yeah, it's just really, really sad. You know, I have friends, I've left Israel 16 years ago, and I have friends, and they, on the one side, they say to me, oh, you did well to leave 16 years ago, because it's only become worse, and it is getting even more worse. Yeah, and they do feel persecuted, and they feel very limited in what they can do, but they feel that they're too late to leave now. In, on the one hand, and on the other hand, they feel very committed, and I admire their commitments to doing their political actions. And there's so much to be done in every possible area. It's just incredibly sad because, as I said, you always belong to that place. You never actually leave home, in a sense, not just because you keep visiting it. It's always going to be a part of you. And so to see what has become of that part of you is horrifying. I try not to read too much of the news because I feel it's just really, it's poisoning me.
It's at the center of a lot of the Middle Eastern wars, really.
Yeah.
And while Israel is very strong with their army and their weapons, they're exerting influence, and of course you've got the American support of them. So I think, really, while America is still supporting...
Yeah, we used to joke that Israel is the 53rd or 54th country of... State of the United States, yeah.
But it would possibly be one of the most powerful.
Yes, it's definitely got very strong hold of a lot of technology, of military technology and money and... power, yep.
Well, in building a new country, they did the most fantastic job.
In some ways.
They just stopped. They just didn't stop when it needed to stop.
No, I think I disagree here with you. I think it's never been established in an honestly fair way.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think if to take a religious symbolism, it was incepted by sin.
Oh, really?
That's how I see it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think if I can quote, this is a term that I didn't come up with. It's by Professor Oren Yiftach-El, and he termed Israel not as a democracy, but as an ethnocracy. So it's a democracy only for one ethnos, which is the Jewish ethnos. And even that is not a really on equal terms, because you have the Ashkenazi Jews and the Sephardi or the Mizrahi Jews. And the way Ashkenazi Jews were treated in Europe is the same way that they treated the Mizrahi Jews in Israel. Right. So they discriminated against them. They thought they were not good enough Jews. And they could be the cheap human power, human labor that could do the hard jobs, the manual labor. And if they'll be corrected and they will be civilized in the right means, they'll become good Jews in the end. And so that colonization has happened on as a double whammy, so to speak. And there in that process, the Ashkenazi Jews have orientalized the Mizrahi Jews. That's why they're called Mizrahi. Mizrahi means of the Orient.
Yes.
And that's how they, and they placed them in that social political hierarchy at the bottom. And then the Palestinians were not even in that social hierarchy at all, because they were deemed as the enemy rather than, you know, be deemed as partners, equal partners to start off with. And so, and I'm not saying that they're, you know, Palestinians or the Arabs don't have any faults. I'm just saying it was incepted in a, by sin, and it was it started off on the wrong foot because of ideology, and because the establishment of Israel was part or the result of the Zionist ideology. It didn't just come out land from nowhere. And so,
and that's the root of the problem is Zionism.
Yeah.
Which is the Jewish is it's the Jewish homeland.
Zionism is a Jewish nationalist ideology. So it's a combination, or used to be a combination. It's gone through changes in the last few decades of socialism and nationalism, and that includes patriotism as well. And, I would say capitalism as well. It's just an amalgamation with a messianic view that the new Jew is going to be reborn by the connection with the land. That's why the land is such a big contested issue, the land and the hold of the land. And that's how, in my view, the archaeology has got a huge importance of making that land belong to the Jewish people, and proving and bringing out all these what I do not see as the reason or the justification for the land hold, but the archaeology has an important role to play in proving that this was the land of the Jewish people, or the Israelites, or the Hebrews, or whatever we call them in that era, and therefore it belongs to the Jewish people now.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. But the land and the landhold is definitely something that was a principle in how this Zionist ideology was constituted, and it's a main thread that, as I said, takes us back in history to different eras, but also leads us to the future, where it has an exclusive hold, an exclusive right to determine which would be the boundaries. And with that, I tend to disagree, because I don't think it leads to any practical solution, and it doesn't recognize the existence of other peoples on that land. And even if it wasn't continuously, you know, for thousands of years, I don't really think it matters that much. And, as I said, it doesn't really recognize the faults and the mistakes that have been done in that process. So, yes, I do believe that the Jewish people deserve a state of their own.
Yes.
But I believe that the Palestinians have a right for a state of their own as well.
So a two-state solution?
That's a possibility, yeah, but you have to include in that a serious discussion about how to, you know, share and care about Jerusalem.
Yes, that's the sticking point, isn't it?
Yeah, Jerusalem. And the right of return for the refugees, that is, again, a very important topic for discussion and finding a settlement and a resolution around that. And this is not a case like, you know, for some iwi here, where you just paid the money and yes. Give them, you can't really pay money for that. And
I don't think you can here, but never mind.
Yeah. And you just have to, you know, give the land back. But there are Jewish settlements on that land, so you have to discuss whether you're clearing these settlements, or what are you going to do with all these people?
Yes.
Yeah, but you just have to be brave and open everything for discussion and have no sacred cows. because sacred cows, they just, you know, they tread on the same land and they just keep eating that grass and regurgitating the history.
Yes, yes. And I mean, there's two entirely different ways of looking at the history.
Mm.
I mean, who got there first? We really don't know.
Well, that's a question I would really like to completely wave off.
Yeah.
Completely take off the discussion table, because I do not think it matters.
Right.
Yeah.
What matters is how we work with two nationalities there now.
Yeah, and how we recognize the right of both people to live on the land and share and be as fair as possible, as equal as possible, and, you know, make a better future for the children of everybody, not just our children. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Well, I love that, as you've said. And sometimes I get a bit upset on Facebook because I see people writing anti-Semitic things when they really need to just address Zionism.
Mm.
And it's for people to understand that difference.
Yeah.
Is quite important.
Yeah. Yeah. I think my partner is very sensitive socially. And so he says to me, it's really hard to find out whether this person that you're talking to is just finding excuses to legitimize their anti-Semitism, or they really do have compassion and they do actually understand the course of history and what has happened, and they want to make it better. So sometimes it's a really dodgy, it's a fine line, and it's quite hard to pin out. Yeah, I find that you have people sort of camouflaged or looking for an excuse to, you know, vent out, and along comes their anti-Semitic views.
Well, I think maybe some of that in this day and age comes from concerns about the banking system and concerns about the Palestinians, rather than a deep anti-Semitic view.
Mm.
It's more about the politics that goes in with it all, is what I would have observed.
Mm. Well, I think the key word you used, which is concern, if I can analyze you, what you just said.
Very briefly, because we're running out of time.
Yeah, I think just the actual terminology makes a huge difference. When it becomes a concern, then it instantly evokes anxieties. And then we're getting to this gray area that is really, you know, it's a way to control people, to evoke these anxieties in them and make them fear a certain group, because this group of people is the one that is in control. Now, I don't really believe that this group is in control of anything.
Unfortunately, because I'd love to keep talking, we're going to have to stop there. But thank you very much, Dr. Hadass Orr,
thank
for coming
you
into
for
the
having
studio
me.
Today.
Thank you very much for having me.
You have been listening to Lisa Eyre interviewing Dr. Hadass Orr on Green Planet FM. This interview was sponsored by the Awareness Party. You've just been listening to Green Planet on Planet FM. Join us at the same time next week, 8 a.m. Thursdays, or anytime online at greenplanetfm.com.
I invite you to be able to come to greenplanetfm.com, where we have over 400 interviews in our database, which you can readily download and listen to be able to inspire yourself to become the change you want to see in the world, and become involved in caring for your children and grandchildren's future. We are also on Facebook, on Green Planet FM, and ourplanet.org. Please come and love us. This is Tim Lynch.
And or Lisa Eyre.
And Liz Gunn.
In the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful week. We look forward to being with you next week. I say kia kaha and haere rā.